stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm continuing to talk about the myths that we believe about change and how they get in our way and make it difficult for us to do what we want to do. And I'm going to play the first part of an interview I did with Betty Garrett, star of stage, screen, TV, you name it. Betty has done it. Actually invented the t-shirt. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. Welcome back if you've been here before. Welcome forward if this is the first time you've heard this show, and I hope that you'll stay and hear it again. For those of you who may be new, I spend the first half of my show talking about why people can't do what they want to do when they want to do it. We all seem to believe in this culture that we ought to be able to do whatever we want to do whenever we want to do it. And I know from many years of private practice as a therapist that that just isn't true. Much of the time I am talking about concepts in the book I wrote, which is called When You Can, You Will. And if you're curious about that and you haven't been there before, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com, and you can find information about the book, about the audiobook, the workbook, anything you want to know about me, and the CD from which that first song that opened the show is coming. And the second half of the show, I play interviews from a series that I'm doing called Anatomy of an Artist. And in this show, the artist that whose interview I am playing is Betty Garrett, just the most remarkable long career in movies, TV, film, movies and film, cabaret, vaudeville, Bosch circuit, you name it. Betty's been there, done that, and won the T-shirt, created the T-shirt. I'm going to, in the beginning of this show, I'm going to continue to talk about the myths that we believe about change, which, as in myths, are not necessarily true. But because we believe them, they have an impact on what we can do, what we can't do, and how we are surprised when we have done something. Last week, I talked about the myth that is so prevalent in this society that if you just want something enough and you try hard enough, you can have it. Be whatever you want, you can have whatever you want. It's just a question of wanting it and intending it and trying it. Well, I just don't believe that's true. I think that's a myth, and that's what I talked about in the last show. In this show, myth number two is that when we make a change in our life, the only thing that's going to be different is the change we made. Because we want to make these changes, whatever they are, we focus on that. That will be different, and that will make it better. I will be happier, healthier, smarter, sexier, more lovable, whatever it is, when I have made this change. And the only thing that will be different is that I will now be thinner, have a college degree, be married, have more money, have a baby, know how to tap dance, whatever it is that the change that we want to make is. I will make this change. I will be different in this way, or life will be different for me, and that's that. Well, it isn't true. No change, virtually no change, maybe I should not make that an absolute. You can email me if you can think of a change that qualifies here. I believe, I have not seen them, virtually no change is unconnected to other things. So you've been overweight, you lose the weight, you are, in fact, healthier, you look better according to the standards of our culture, maybe you are even sexier looking. Well, there are consequences to that which may be unintended. Maybe you will get more attention from the opposite sex, but you won't know what to do with it. You will be uncomfortable, unprepared, unskilled. So there's just this tiny shift which gets you what you want and also puts you in a position of discomfort. I saw a perfect example of this, the law of unintended consequences, on an Oprah show, ironically. It was at a time when Oprah lost a great deal of weight. And the show was triggered, actually, by a lot of hate mail that she got. Clearly, she was surprised by it. This is one of the unintended consequences of this action. Clearly, she expected to get mail that said, "You're our inspiration. You go, girl. We're so proud of you. We're so glad to have you as a role model." But what she got instead was, "You were one of us. Now you're not one of us. You betrayed us. You left us behind. We're not a part of you anymore. How could you do this to us?" This, of course, was a completely unintended consequence of her intention to lose that weight. And she dedicated the show to this experience. She had three couples on the show. They were all women. They were a mother and a daughter, two very close friends, and I believe the third couple were cousins. In each case, all six of the women had been overweight, and in each case, one of the women had lost a lot of weight. And they each talked about the price that they had to pay in terms of the relationship. Previously, the relationship bond had been a lot about the fact, the shared fact, of their overweightness. They would share diets, exercise, they joined gyms together, they read books about weight loss, they went shopping for skinny clothes or fakie facades, as a client of mine once called them. They made jokes about skinny people. They bewailed the fact that this is a culture that is so hard on people over a certain weight. Every aspect of the weight relatedness they shared, and it was a comfort to both of them, and it was the basis of the relationship. Even those relationships which are blood-related, like cousins and mothers and daughters, the mother and daughter would sit around at night eating Rocky Road and snickering and sharing their guilt and their guilty pleasure. So when one of them lost the weight, so much of what had bonded that relationship was now gone. The skinny one was now the one they used to make fun of. The cost to the relationship was significant. In at least one case, it was hard for them to stay related. This, of course, is what I was talking about earlier, the law of unintended consequences. Whenever we make a change, especially a significant change like losing weight, or going back to school, if you didn't graduate from school and all of your friends or people who didn't graduate from high school, and you get your GED and now become able to get the kinds of jobs that they can't get, or all of your friends are high school graduates but none of them have gone to college, you're the first one. Now your life is full of stuff which these other people have no access to. You know things, want things, experience things that they don't. There's no way that this cannot alter the basis of the relationship. In a later show, a much later show, I'm going to talk about a concept in the book called breaking the relationship contract. But this is one of the things that happens when you make a change. But there are other things. You move from one state to another because you can't get a job in the state you're in, because you need to get away from your family, because you can no longer bear the weather in the place where you're living, and your focus has been on, I really can't stand this anymore. I really have to get out of here. I have to get out of here. I have to get out of here. And then you get out of here, and suddenly, and actually I know this one because I moved from Los Angeles, where I had lived for 20 years, to Florida. And suddenly, you don't know anybody, and you don't have a doctor, and you don't know where the grocery store is, or you find the grocery store, but it's a really weird one, and you don't know where anything is. And maybe you don't know anybody there, or you don't have any close friends, or maybe you just can't get around. So you got the change. You got the thing that you were so focused on. But here, again, the law of unintended consequences. Now, I believe that one of the reasons that we have this myth is because if we were really aware of all of the things that were likely to change when we made this change, maybe we wouldn't be able to make it. So our unconscious puts blinders on us for that. But it is possible to prepare for some of the changes that may accompany the change that you want to make. And so as long as you go on believing this myth that nothing else will change, you're not able to prepare for some of the changes you may incur. Okay, so as I'm talking, are you thinking about a change you want to make? Has it occurred to you that there might be some unintended consequences to this change? Good. Keep thinking about it. And if you want to talk to me about that, go up on my website, click on Contact Me, and let me know, and I'll get back to you. And now, Betty Garrett. I'm happy for you that you're going to be able to share Betty Garrett with me. She's really, well, I'm not going to continue to look for words to describe Betty. You can hear her for yourself.
Okay, so I'm sitting here with Betty Garrett in her home, which is under, well, not under construction, but under renovation in preparation for our wedding.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's going to take place in a short period of time.
Right, yeah.
We've been talking about how it's whenever you're going to have some event, you suddenly see all these things that need to be done.
And it makes you get them done.
And it makes you get them
which
done.
Which is a blessing.
It is a blessing.
Yeah.
Okay, so Betty was asking me what we would talk about, because I know Betty now for about 25 years, I think.
Right.
And we've talked about everything.
I think so.
So I'm doing this series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have an agenda, really, and I don't have questions, but I'm asking people to talk about how they became what they are, how they put together a life of using their art. And my God, you have done this all your life, have you not?
Well, I guess I really have. Looking back, my mother and father divorced, and she moved up to Seattle, and she became manager of the sheet music department in a big music store in Seattle called Sherman Clay. So I kind of grew up in that store. And it's no wonder that I gravitated toward music, because there was all this music, and the top floor was every piano, you know, Steinway, Bechstein, you know, all of you name it. And then the next floor were musical instruments, and there was an instrument there that fascinated me. It was called the theremin, and it was a big box with a rod on the top and another rod on the side that regulated the volume. And when you turned it on, the closer your finger got to that big rod that was sticking up, the higher the tone. Well, that fascinated me. And then I got so I could play the pagan love song. It was my specialty. And what is really remarkable about it, if you'll just look in back of you.
Yes.
It's not the big box anymore.
This is it? This is it there?
My kids got me that for my birthday. I kept telling them, if you ever find a theremin any place, I would love to have it.
Oh, my God.
And by God, they found me a theremin. So I am still kind of trying to get back to the pagan love song. I can do pretty well on Amazing Grace. That sort of works. But I'm not going to show you because I'm not good enough yet. But, you know, that was my, and I could play the ukulele. I learned to play the ukulele. And then on the ground floor were records, phonograph records, and they had little booths, and you could go in and sit and listen to whatever record you wanted to listen to. And then where my mother worked was the sheet music, and these long, long banks of wonderful sheet music. I have some of the covers over there by the piano that are framed, because they were little works of art.
Yes.
And my mother would go in to this little room with the piano, and customers would come in and give her a piece of sheet music and say, what does this sound like? And she would play it. And I would stand in the corner and listen. So I guess, in a way, that's what started me, particularly in music. Although when I first started really interested at all, it was in dancing. And I went to a wonderful teacher called Mary Ann Wells in Seattle, Washington. And there was a red-headed boy who used to stand in back of me and make fun of me. And his name was Marcel Leplat. And he later became Mark Platoff in the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. Then he became Mark Platt. And Mark Platt was in a number of movies. I think one of his most famous things was in, I think it was Tonight and Every Night with Rita Hayworth, where he did a whole ballet thing about Hitler, was the dictator. And I do remember
that. I think I do.
Now, what was fun about it is later on, my husband Larry, and he did a picture with Rita Hayworth, and they sang duets and trios with Rita.
Wow.
And when Larry and I were married, I still call him Marcel, was my daddy, because I didn't have anybody out here that I knew that long. So he stood up for me and was my daddy.
Wow.
You asked me this question, a long-winded answer, but all of these things kind of contributed to the fact that I guess I was meant to do this.
Oh.
In school, I was always the one who said, you know, you do this and I'll do this and I'll play the ukulele and you dance. And with my twin cousins that I spent summer with a lot, I would always do that.
So let's put on a show?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it was, I know when the last play that I did at the Annie Wright Seminary in Tacoma, where my high school, the bishop, we did Twelfth Night, and I played Mariah, which is one of the best parts because it's funny. And the bishop came up to my mother and said, what are you going to do with your daughter? I think he asked it sort of like, you know, if you don't do something, she'll be a gangster's mauler. You know, it was that kind of question. And my mother said, what do you think I better do? And he said, I think you better put her on the stage.
But you're kidding.
And I'm not kidding. My mother said he said it in that way, as though you better do that or she's going
to
get out of hand.
To save her, you know? Right. So a question I had was, did your mother encourage this?
Oh, absolutely.
So when the bishop said, I mean, it wasn't like he had to convince her to put you on the stage.
At that point.
And how old were you when that happened?
I was 16. I graduated from high school when I was 16. The thing was that I did everything when I was a kid. I wrote, I drew, I didn't know whether I wanted to go to art school or journalist school or what. And I got very good grades. I look back and I wonder how that happened. But anyway, I got good grades, so I got entries to, I think, Stanford. I just thought of the other school, which was a very high-class girls' school. But when I got this scholarship to the Neighborhood Playhouse, my mother she really took charge in that. She just felt that was the best thing for me to do. Because I had been taking a lot of dancing, and Martha Graham was one of the teachers at the Neighborhood Playhouse. And I had been studying in summertime in the University of Washington with a number of her students, and her group actually used to come and teach. And so I think by that point, what I really wanted to do was be a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really the reason why I wanted to go to the Neighborhood Playhouse, because Martha Graham was a teacher there. And I think my mother knew that was the best place. If I'd gone to the University of Washington, I would have majored in boys. You know? But going to the Neighborhood Playhouse, which was 9 to 6 every day, and you took one or two really stiff dance classes. I used to get so stiff sometimes I couldn't get in and out of bed. And then you had speech, you had acting, you had Shakespeare, you had choreography, all of these elements.
You had no time for boys.
No, well, there were boys there I had time for. But usually we were doing scenes together.
Right.
And every once in a while you sneak off and steal a kiss or so. But the thing was that I really wanted to do that.
Yes.
I realized looking back that that was something, was a passion for me, and I think that's important.
It's so interesting because it sounds, when you describe it, like you weren't conscious of how much you wanted it.
Yeah.
But you wound up in it anyway, and then discovered that it was what you needed to do, meant to be.
I think that's absolutely right, and I thank my mother for somehow knowing that was the right way.
It's so interesting.
Guiding me in that direction.
Because so many parents would have chosen Stanford, you know, the University of Washington.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Had she wanted to be on the stage, your mother?
No, my mother was raised a strict Baptist. And dancing was a sin.
Oh, my.
And she used to tell that her whole courtship with my father was sneaking off to go dancing. He was a terrific ballroom dancer.
So she was a little bit of a rebel, your mother.
Yes, so she, I think that's one of the reasons that she, her dream was to see me dancing, because it was prohibited in her family.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But it did, so I want to say set the stage for you to... And so I imagine that she was so proud of you.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And I think I fulfilled a lot of dreams for her, which is wonderful. I think about her so often, she gave up a good job in Seattle, Washington, went to New York with me with no job, and she had a friend who came with us, and they shared rent of an apartment, so that made it a little easier. But she took a big chance. Because she was so knowledgeable about music, she got a job very quickly with Shermer, which is a big music publishers. So she did all right, but it was a very courageous thing for her to do.
Yes, and very, very much about you. And
yes.
Not about her.
Yes, I think about that a lot too, because I think about my kids. It's always been divided in my life, and I feel sometimes that I don't give myself completely to my family the way my mother gave it to me. But at the same time, I feel badly that my mother didn't have other things beside me.
You know, it's what I'm thinking is your mother's childhood denied her permission to be who she was.
Yeah.
So she gave you that permission.
Yeah.
So in an ironic way, her childhood predisposed her to deny herself and give that to you. But your childhood predisposed you to feel entitled, you know?
I love your whole explanation. it makes me feel much better.
Well, you know, and I want to say something else about it. I don't know exactly how to say this. I haven't said anything about you in terms of this interview. I haven't told the audience anything about you. And at some point soon, I would like you to describe what your career has been. You're a national treasure, Betty. I mean, it is absolutely true. You have given pleasure to millions and millions of people in every possible venue that there is. You just continue to do it. So if the universe was watching, I'm sure it said to your mother, give this one all you've got, because she's going to give it all back to the world.
Oh, that's nice, yeah.
Do you know?
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. You know, maybe we could just interrupt this here a little bit for you to talk about just to give a kind of chronology of your career.
Well, from Annie Wright Seminary, which I've gone everywhere on scholarship. I had a scholarship to that, fortunately. And as I say, all during my childhood, I went to a small boarding school, and I was always the one who was telling all the kids, you know, you do this and I'll do that and we'll put on a show. And
a natural director.
And I started to also do monologues. And I lived in this little boarding house where there was a darling, lovely lady named Margaret Bateman. I'll never forget her. Big, tall, gorgeous face. She had a sort of look of like a Katharine Hepburn, that sort of look. And I used to do these monologues. Where in hell I found them in my head was like a Swedish woman getting on a bus.
You mean you invented them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my
God. I
would
just improvise them. And I gather the other kids around me. I was the oldest one. I was 13, and they were all 8, 9, and 10. And I'd make them sit and listen. And I'd do this. I remember this one about the Swedish woman on the bus. And she said, you won't let me take my little dog on the bus. You know? And I'm getting off the bus. And I did another one about, my favorite thing was to play the demonstrators in the 10-cent stores who say, now ladies, you will take the powder and you know. And I did that whole thing. And I invented these things. And Margaret Bateman, who was one of the heads of this little boarding school, came to my mother and said, you should take her to see Ruth Draper.
Mm.
And Anya Enters, I don't know who you know.
No,
Anya
I don't.
Anya Enters was a dance mime. And how Margaret Bateman knew about these people, I don't know. And so my mother did. When they came to town for concerts, my mother took me to see these people. When I saw Ruth Draper standing up there doing what I love to do, is making up these wonderful dramas, just one person. And I think that planted something
yes.
in my head.
Well, it confirmed for you that your instincts were right on.
Completely unconsciously, believe me.
Yet again.
None of this was conscious.
But it's yet again, there's some
so, well,
thing.
The thing is going from then the Annie Wright Seminary to my scholarship at the Neighborhood Playhouse, 2 years of studying with people like Sanford Meisner, mm. Martha Graham, Louis Horst. We had Margaret Webster teaching Shakespeare, who was the authority on Shakespeare in those days. And, I mean, wonderful, wonderful people. And I had 2 years of that. Then my very first job was kind of two jobs at once. Martha invited me to be with her group in a concert where she had one big number she was doing was an augmented group. So she needed about 4 or 5 extra dancers. And so I was not made part of the group, but mm-hmm. I was part of that auxiliary group. So I got to do two concerts with her. And one was at Carnegie Hall.
Wow.
And it was on New Year's Eve. Christmas Eve. And someone said to me, oh, you poor thing, you have to work on Christmas Eve. And I said, are you kidding? I'm dancing with Martha Graham at Carnegie Hall. What a Christmas present. But at the same time, I got this nutty job with Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater.
Oh, my God.
And I'm just a kind of a walk-on part. And actually, it became more than a walk-on because it was in a show called Danton's Death, which was about the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. And Orson had dug up a whole center of the stage, the Mercury Theater, with steps that went down into the bowels of the basement, you know. And most of us all stood down there underneath making noises and singing songs, you know, like, come dance the Carmignola, wait for the gun, and wait for the gun, and doing all kinds of noises and down with Danton, up with Robespierre, you know. And one of the things that is my favorite story is one night in rehearsal, our rehearsals were crazy. We would rehearse from 6 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock in the morning.
Holy cow.
And I'd stumble home and sleep all day. And we got $15 a week for that. Anyway, one night, Orson, whom I just loved, one of the most picturesque people I've ever known. At that point, he was a tall, slender,
handsome,
darling guy with a baby face. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want noises over a village at night. So people were, you know, he said, one cast member said, a dog barking, you know. And Orson said, that's good, that's good. Somebody said, some people snoring, and, you know, so forth and so on, crickets. And I lifted up my hand. I said, a baby crying. Mm-hmm. And he said, good, good. Let me hear. So I went, like this. And everybody laughed. And Orson got furious. He said, don't laugh. That sounds exactly like my new baby daughter. So I became the baby cry. And one of the cast members was Joseph Cotton.
Oh my.
He became a very famous actor after that.
And Citizen Kane.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And many other wonderful...
But I mean with Orson.
Yeah, mm-hmm. With Orson. And Joe Cotton said, sex noises in the night. So Orson, of course, loved that. He said, no, let me hear you. So Joseph did all of this sort of, oh, yes, you know. And Orson said, great. The only trouble is, after about 2 or 3 weeks of the show down here in the basement in the dark, Joe got very bored. And so his sex noises would be like, ah, yeah, yeah, ah. So anyway, that was my first year out of Neighborhood Playhouse. And when you consider how lucky I was
to find,
you know, this dancing with this wonderful dancer and part of the Mercury Theater. Unfortunately, Danton's death died. It did not run very long. But then I seemed to go from one thing to another. One of them was into the World's Fair, the 1939-1940 World's Fair. That was a huge pageant about railroads, and they had an actual railroad yard on each side of this enormous stage. It was outside, and there were like bleachers looking at the stage part, and these locomotives would come racing across the stage, and it was the history of railroads. So there was the Tom Thumb engine, and all around that, the choreographer had choreographed a wedding party. And the Tom Thumb came on and the whole wedding party, and we all danced and did a big Strauss waltz around the so-called station, mm-hmm. and then put the bride and groom into the little train in back of the Tom Thumb, and it pulled off. Then there was the one of the most touching scenes is a big yellow boxcar sort of that was supposedly had been the car that took Lincoln's coffin across the United States. And in that scene, we played farmers and
a grieving nation.
Yeah, and people would come up and touch the boxcar and stuff like that, and the train would slowly go off. And there were all these different scenes. And the second year, I played that for 2 years, we were off during the winter months, but then we would come back in the summer. And the second year, the director decided to do a cross-section of a club car on a modern train. So the engine was huge, actual train, you know, mm-hmm. and it would come on and it would be drawing this club car And of course, one side was sliced off so that the audience could look into it. And there were people there having drinks and the waiter waiting on them. And then it came to the end of the car, which was a little...
caboose?
No, it was the end of the club car was a little cabin. You know, the trains at that time did not have the berths or whatever you call them. But this was a little private room, which the trains had. And my job was to come in with the porter, and he would bring in my bags, and I would tip him, and he would leave. And I would take off my hat and put it up, and take off my jacket and hang it up, and then take off my blouse and hang it up, and slip down my skirt.
You're kidding!
And I did this very modest striptease. And I would roll my stockings down very seductively, and I would get down to my brassiere and panties, and I would reach back and start to take off my brassiere just as the train would pull up. I would say, I'd tell this story once, and I said, so then... Then the train would go off, and he said, and half the men in the audience. Anyway, it's very funny because years and years later, there was a big, what was the magazine? Was it Vanity Fair? One big magazine, and I don't think it's in print anymore, but they did a whole article about the 39-40 World's Fair. Mm-hmm. The title was, That Was a Fair That Was, yes. Because it was a great fair. And in the article it said, I wanted to go see Gypsy Rose Lee in the entertainment section, but my parents wouldn't let me do that. They took me instead to the radio, to the railroad show, which they thought would be very educational. And he said, I got to see a striptease anyway. But I love that he didn't remember my name or anything like that. He said, I got to see this girl do a real striptease.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
And again, you know, you're just sort of writing this magic ride into show business.
Yeah, it seemed to me that I never went very long without some kind of a job. But I think, I know in between the 2 years of the World's Fair, I got a job as a chorus girl in the Latin Quarter in Boston. And I often think about my mother, how she let me do this, because that's a little different than getting a mm-hmm. concert with Martha Graham. And by that time, I'd had enough of all kinds of dancing mm-hmm. so that I could be a chorus girl. And I went up to Boston, and they had digs, as you call them, in England, for girls in the chorus who from out of town, a place, a wonderful old brownstone front house called the Charlotte Cushman Club. Mm. And it was for young theatrical women, it was called. Mm. And so I was put up there, and I shared a really nice, big, huge room, but with two other girls. Mm-hmm. And I think we paid...
It's a little like stage door.
I think, yeah, very much. And I think we paid $12 a week for that room, but divided between the three of us, it was only $4 a week.
Wow.
But I only made $25. So, but that was really fun. The thing that's funny about it is that after a couple of weeks, Lou Walters, who's now very famous because Barbara Walters mm-hmm. talks about her father, he of course owned the Latin Quarter, and evidently, I think it was his wife, Barbara Walters' mother, who said, that chorus line looks like a bunch of hookers.
Ooh.
And he said, you should get rid of them. And they, you know, they're too old for this, and they, you know, they look coarse. And so Lou Walters said, okay, we'll fire them. He said, you can keep that little girl on the end that swings her behind.
He said that?
That's me. And I don't know, somebody else told me this, so that's, you know, I'm
so quoting. Did they fire everybody and keep you?
They fired everybody. And the thing that was sad about it is my two roommates were really accomplished tap dancers, mm-hmm. and I wasn't. And I'd make these...
But apparently you had a swinging behind.
Well, I'd make these two poor girls at night teach me the steps, because I just didn't know enough about tap dancing. And they got fired. And I felt so terrible. I said, I'm quitting. And they said, don't be silly. We'll get other jobs, you know. So I stayed on. I was there for the whole winter.
Just and you?
No. They brought in a whole new line of girls.
Oh.
And they were actually, I don't think they were much better than the ones we had, but they were favorites of the patrons, who a great many of them were the Irish Mafia up there in Boston. And so there were a lot of gals who, you know, knew these guys who had come into the club.
Yeah.
And so we had a whole different line, chorus line, but I was still there.
Wow.
And so I stayed, and I was there for for one whole winter. And I finally came back home.
When you came home to New York, you mean, right? Were you living with your mother?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, my mother had an apartment, and we had an apartment. And so, as I say, it surprised me that she let me go off to Boston mm-hmm. and work in a nightclub. You know? But there was fairly strict regulations. You had to sit with customers who requested you, but you did not go out with them. I mean, maybe some of them did.
Right.
But
you didn't have to. That wasn't part of the job.
I didn't have to, no. And I certainly would not have, wouldn't have wanted to. I remember one night, two guys asked for me to sit at their table. And I swear one of them looked just like George Raft.
Huh.
And they, we were sitting there, and I'm sure, pretty sure they were part of the sort of Irish mob.
Yeah.
And this one guy kind of started to come on to me, and the other guy said, just like George Raft, I swear, said, leave the kid alone. She's a good kid.
So you were protected in so many ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It was probably the year after the World's Fair that I started to go up to the Borscht Circuit.
Mm.
And a place called White Roe Lake was my first job. And I was part of a little dance group. And I think we worked for $65 for the whole summer.
Wow.
But you got your board and room.
Oh, yeah, and it was wonderful up there.
And it was great. And we did wonderful shows. And Danny Kaye had been one of their staff, and he used to come up there a lot, and he would be part of the shows. And he saw me do a couple of things, so there was a little, they didn't call it Off-Broadway then, but it took place in a little theater in the Barbizon Plaza Hotel, and Danny recommended me, having seen me up at White Roe Lake. So, that Danny kind of became my mentor. He was really, always boosting me. And so one summer, I went up, I think it was the first summer that I went to Tamament, which was the famous.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that wasn't in the Borscht Circuit, it was in Pennsylvania.
Right.
But...
and it's what Dirty Dancing is based on.
Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. yeah. And of course, Danny used to come up to Tamament a lot. And his manager, a man named Lou Mandel, mm-hmm. lived in a little adjoining community that used to be like permanent residence in the summer, and that was Lou Mandel. And Danny told Lou Mandel, he says, watch this girl. So Lou started watching me, and the next thing I know, Lou is advising me and became my manager.
Wow.
And was my manager until he died. And now Milo, his son, whom I knew at 4 years old, is now my manager.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Again, it's like this, I don't know, you know, it's like you float from one thing to another.
Exactly.
You know, I've heard this a lot from people who have really made a life in show business, as a performer, that things dovetail for them, that people do things for them, that things show up.
Yeah.
It's a kind of meant to be.
Yeah, it is a... I really don't understand it. Because, I mean, Lou took such good care of me. He always kept an eye on what was really right for me. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when I got married, Larry inherited Lou, and then what saved our lives really was when the blacklist came along. By this time, Lou had gotten Larry into the building business. Lou had been in real estate in New York and understood real estate very well, and Larry, after the blacklist, couldn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
So Lou began to involve him, and Larry became really a builder.
Wow.
He contracted all these buildings. He learned how to do everything. Do plumbing, he could do gardening, he could do repair, you know, anything. And so that really stood us in good stead.
But again, here it is, you know, this Lou, I mean, this
That's
is not
right.
a traditional... This is not a traditional thing that managers do.
No.
You know.
And Lou and his wife Ruth just became like family.
Yeah.
And he was very involved that we should have plenty of financial backing, you know, and particularly came in handy when Larry couldn't get jobs.
Right.
And the whole market kind of changed anyway, so I think every artist should have some kind of income that comes from someplace else, because you can't depend on financial support as an actor or an artist.
Of any kind.
Yeah.
No.
Once again, we hear the theme, don't do it for the money, over and over again. Okay, I'm running out of time, not an uncommon thing. But before I do, I want to play a cut from a compilation CD of much of the music that Betty's recorded over the years, with a lot of fascinating other people singing along. I'm going to do two more of these next week, but this week I want to play the Humphrey Bogart Rumba, which Betty recorded with the Harold Mooney Orchestra and the Crew Chiefs on, if you can believe it, January 20th, 1949, exactly 60 years ago today. And if you listen to the end, you actually hear Humphrey Bogart chiming in.
Care for Humphrey Bogart, then aim it after any star that you desire. Mickey Rooney, Errol Flynn, Jennifer Jones or Gable, Gloria De Haven, Evelyn Keyes, Harry James or Grable, Judy Garland, Janet Lee, Crosby or Myrtle Long, Frank Sinatra, Larry Parks or Mrs. Jolson's boy. This is the Humphrey Bogart Rumba. They play it every night at Slapsies and Cyril's. But if you do not care for Humphrey Bogart, then you can call up the Lucille Ball, John Lund or Danny Kaye. No matter what you may say, it's still Humphrey Bogart Rumba.
This is the Humphrey Bogart Rumba.
Humphrey's a
toughest men upon the screen.
Humphrey Bogart is the star we admire.
Humphrey's the toughest man I've ever seen.
If you do not care for Humphrey,
I'll moiter the bum that don't like Humphrey.
Leave it after any star that you desire.
Ava Gardner, Keenan Wynn, Deborah Carr or Crawford. Maybe Red Skelton, Gregory Peck, Johnson Kelly or Lawford. Janie Powell, June Allison, Ricardo Montalban, Esther Williams, Dinah Shore, or even Betty Garrett. Never mind. This is the Humphrey Bogart Rumba. They play it every night at Slap Season Zeros. But if you do not care for Humphrey Bogart, then you can call it the Johnny Don, Bob Hope or Turhan Bay, or call it the Lauren Bacall or the Laurence Olivier. No matter what you may say, it's still the Humphrey Bogart Rumba.
All right, everybody, let's dance.
Humphrey Bogart!
Amazing. I don't know about you, but while I was listening to that, I was thinking that it's like a little snapshot of all the stars that were shining in the movie Firmament 60 years ago. It's a capsule version of what was going on in the movie industry. And I find that absolutely delightful. Thank you, Betty, and Harold Mooney, and whoever wrote the song, and Humphrey Bogart for your good humor. So just enough time to thank Josh Hackney yet again for his invaluable help getting this show on and getting me through all of my computer glitches. And to say to you that I hope once again you've heard something that you can use or something that entertained you. In any case, something that makes you want to come back, because I will be here next week with Betty Garrett again. And boy, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on of singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't.